at all.
Please the court. Yep. Outside the courtroom, when we have a question, we ask the internet. It can be the simplest of things. Last night I Googled, where's the best place to eat in Jefferson City? It can also be the most important things.
Can you tell us what it said?
The consensus seemed to be Madison's. It can also be the most important of things. Recently I've Googled, where's the best place to send children to school in Kansas City? The internet is an important tool. It's an invaluable tool. But that's outside the courtroom. Inside the courtroom, we have two sources of information, and two sources only. The evidence admitted at trial, and the instructions the court gives on the law. Juror Hink acted like he was outside the courtroom. He had a question. Where do punitive damages go? And because he felt, quote, so inadequately informed by the court's instructions, he did what we all would do. He asked the internet. He Googled the question, where do punitive damages go? And he read from the Wikipedia article on that topic. Now, a presumption of prejudice applies to that conduct. And if this court does not apply a presumption of prejudice, it's telling the trial courts that in some cases, it is okay to act like we're outside the courtroom. It's opening a Pandora's box and letting the internet in. That can't be the law. And therefore, the trial court should be reversed.
As you know, opposing counsel says because he was researching a question of law rather than fact, that the cases about presumption don't apply. There shouldn't be a presumption of prejudice.
I think that is exactly opposite of what the law should be. I think that in Missouri, we take the instructions very seriously. We've crafted them over decades. We've spent a lot of time determining exactly what go into those instructions. And I think that the presumption of prejudice does apply. Nationwide, that is the rule, that whether it's a question of fact or a question of law, a presumption of prejudice applies. And I think in our own case, and some dicta does say that. It says that, look, if you do a dictionary, if you look in the dictionary for a term of common parlance, then, okay, we're not going to apply a presumption of prejudice. But if you research a legal term, then we will. And that's stated Viviano.
So does extrinsic evidence include anything that's inconsistent with the evidence in law presented at trial, or does it mean anything that was in addition to what was presented outside the evidence that was presented at trial?
The latter. I think extrinsic evidence is extrinsic evidence, and extrinsic information is extrinsic information. Whether it's consistent or not speaks to whether it's a factor to be considered in whether the presumption of prejudice can be rebutted.
What's the harm if it's consistent?
Well, there are two. The consistency issue breaks down in two ways. One are these innocent discovery cases where the juror goes out and inadvertently stumbles upon the scene. And those cases are different from where the juror intentionally goes out and finds other information. Now, that's a different breed of case. And that's what Travis and Middleton both say. And it's the intent in going outside the trial that creates that presumption. And if it's completely consistent, that would be one of many factors to consider as to whether the presumption can be rebutted. The first factor would be the importance of the term looked for. In this case, punitive damages, the most important thing that was going on at the trial at that time.
Didn't you also argue the Wikipedia information gave him additional information about who got to retain the punitive damages that was not part of our instructions?
That's correct, Your Honor. The consistency issue is largely a red herring, because the information that Juror Hink sought and obtained was not consistent with the instruction. The instruction says you may award punitive damages, you may find a defendant liable for punitive damages if certain things are true. It mentioned nothing about where punitive damages go. The Wikipedia article said that although punitive damages are not intended to, it said that all or some portion of the award will go to the plaintiff. And there was also another link that popped up on the Google search that said, should society get a portion of punitive damages? Now, the clear implication from that is that plaintiff is going to get some of the damages and society is going to get the remainder. And that's true. 50% of it does go to the Missouri Tort Compensation Fund, and 50% does go to the plaintiff. But that's also prejudicial. We can't be telling the jurors that, hey, if you increase your award, your friends and neighbors are going to be getting part of that. And so the consistency issue, I think, is a red herring because the information sought and obtained was not consistent.
What portion did he read aloud? Was that portion actually read aloud, or was that only?
That was read aloud. He said that he read it to himself, and he has the habit of reading aloud. And he can't say whether or not the other jurors heard him. Because we have the presumption of prejudice, any doubt on that is resolved in our favor, and we have to assume that they did hear him.
Now, we try to preserve the sanctity of the jury process. However, we live in a real world, and instructions are applying the law to the facts that are presented. And we lawyers are now, in fact, I was summoned to a jury at one point, no one took me. But Senator McCaskill was on a jury. Now she brings with her an abundance of information, and which she can share with the jury. And if she knew something about punitive damages, which I assume she would, she could share that with the jury if she wanted to. And the law provides for lawyers to be members of, and judges to be members of juries nowadays. And so there's all kinds of information that you know that you bring with you, lay people and lawyers and whoever's being appointed, being called to the jury. Are we there to say, well, if Senator McCaskill's on a jury, she can't share how she created the law or how the law was created when she was a prosecutor or her prosecution experience? I don't think so. So the goal is to try to get the best judges we can from the jury. How do we disgorge prior knowledge of when you go to a jury? Can we say you can't share, if you're a lawyer and you do personal injury work, you cannot share that information with the rest of the jury when you go to the jury?
Well, the law absolutely provides a way for us to handle that situation. First of all, in your hypothetical, Senator McCaskill is talking about what she knows about punitive damages that goes outside the instructions is improper. Now, does that come into evidence to impeach the verdict? No. And unless it comes
in about... I mean, she's on the jury. She's not the lawyer in the case. She's on the jury. She's bringing with her, when she goes in the jury deliberations, what she knows. I don't think you can say you cannot talk about stuff you know if you're in the jury. Every other person in the jury talks about their personal experiences outside of the facts of the case, with respect to what they might know and what their experience. That's why we have juries.
I think I agree and disagree slightly in part. We can of course bring all of our knowledge to deliberations if we're in a jury. However, if we have knowledge of the law that's inconsistent with what the court gives us and in the instructions, I don't think it's proper to advise the other jurors or act on that at all.
Let me ask you a question about your argument a few minutes ago. You said that we were supposed to presume that the other jurors heard it because there's a presumption of prejudice. But once the trial court makes a determination that there was no prejudice, it doesn't matter whether there was a presumption or not, correct?
I disagree. Then
you're saying that it's an irrebuttable presumption and we should assume evidence contrary to what the trial court found about whether there was prejudice. That's a trial court burden. It just tilts the scale one way or the other there, right?
I disagree. Look to the Middleton case. That very thing happened. The trial court found prejudice but didn't apply the proper analysis, and this court reversed.
So to follow up, the finding of no prejudice, isn't that an indication that they found that she met her burden?
No, because the trial court explicitly said and took great pains to say that a presumption of prejudice does not apply. So it's clear that the trial court wasn't applying the proper analysis, did not presume that prejudice occurred, and therefore did not propose.
So you're saying the trial court, since the court didn't presume prejudice, it didn't reach the issue of whether she had overcome a presumption. The
Correct.
Burden would be different. The evidence you would present would be different.
Correct. What the trial court found was there is misconduct here. There is no presumption of prejudice, but I will do a normal prejudice analysis in which the burden would have been on us And under that context,
what's the standard of review? What's the standard of review of the judge's decision?
Well, it's a little bit odd because, in general, it's an abuse of discretion. But there have been so many cases finding that if you don't apply a presumption of prejudice, that it's abuse of discretion.
Right. You're suggesting it's a clear error of law in the way that the judge evaluated whether or not.
I am.
Why, if that's correct, then why wouldn't the proper remedy be to remand for the trial court to determine whether or not the presumption of prejudice was overcome rather than a retrial?
I think that's a waste of judicial resources. I think that we've got all the facts in front of us. Juror Hink testified. We had a hearing on this. We know what happened. We know that a presumption of prejudice cannot be overcome in this case because he testified that he himself was not comfortable where they were going. There was vigorous debate going on. And then after he read the Wikipedia article and made himself, in essence, an expert on punitive damages, the jury went with the very figure that he suggested. And so if a strong presumption of prejudice can't defeat these facts, then it doesn't live up to its name. It's not a strong presumption of prejudice. And this court can enter the judgment that should have been entered, which is a new trial on that issue.
But your brief say you asked for a remand.
Right, for a new trial on the amount of punitive damages. So we would have to put in evidence again, and the jury would have to decide. In other words, we don't just go back to the trial court and have him re-decide his decision. All right, briefly, point one, which is the more important issue for my client, because this case was submitted on a theory that is legally impossible for the Board of Police Commissioners to have committed. We do not control the police retirement system. The jury was instructed that you may fine for the plaintiff if you find that the Board of Police Commissioners refused her disability claim. That is a legal impossibility. We could not have done that. It doesn't matter what testimony there is that we did it. It cannot have occurred. That's one of many submissions, but the law is clear that each theory submitted must be supported by competent evidence. By competent, we mean legally sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Chief Justice Breckinridge, I have my usual handout.
If you will give them to the marshal. Thank you.
You have one in big print?
I did the best I could.
I assume you provided him one to your opponent?
Yes, I have. He's seen it before in a different venue. May it please the court.
Thank you, sir.
I think to start with the point one first, to get it out of the way, the lurking question here is, can you submit or on appeal seek review of submissibility when you abandon your judgment notwithstanding the verdict issue? Can you, under the guise of a claim of instructional error, get to the place of submissibility? Now, we've spent a lot of time in this brief arguing that they simply haven't preserved this issue of alternative submissions. But at the end of the day, as the Court of Appeals properly noted, they abandoned their JNOV appeal, which was the place where submissibility is normally taken up. And can you then circumvent that process and get away from having to make a proper directed verdict motion simply by suggesting that the instruction shouldn't have been given because the case isn't submissible? It seems to me, and I looked at all the cases I could find on it, we don't have a clear rule on that. And I think it would be helpful if the court decides to keep this case to sort of talk about that so we'll have some direction as to what we do. But it seems to me that the law now is set up to have submissibility handled through JNOV motions and instructional error to be about the language itself, whether the instructions would mislead the jury. In any event, we don't think anything was preserved. And even if it was, there was substantial evidence, unrebutted, that Ms. Ross Page had not received a penny in disability. And the fight about what kind of disability there was a fight that should have been taken up in cross-examination, and it wasn't. It should have been taken up in instructional definitions, and it wasn't. And the only evidence that the jury heard on that issue was evidence that said there had been not a single penny or cent, I believe is the quote, on of disability pay.
I did go back and look at the transcript and look at the motions filed and everything that I could find that used the word retirement or disability in there, and it does appear that everybody was talking about the long-term retirement that is not controlled by the board, and on appeal now you're saying no, she was talking about you switched and you're talking about the other disability and that she was objecting to the one that is within their control. But if you look at Exhibit 48, you look at the testimony, you look at the motion for new trial and your response and how you defend it was supported, you were talking about the other retirement.
Well, Judge, all I'd say to you is the question now is, was there instructional error? And the instruction used the word disability without definition. There was no objection to the instruction. And there was no clarification of the evidence. And irrespective of what the evidence and the argument of the lawyers afterwards was, the jury was asked to decide, based on the evidence it heard, whether she had been paid disability and without definition. And, Your Honor, I don't think you can now come in and wish you'd argued it differently.
And do we look at her testimony about not getting a penny in context and in context if you're clarifying that she thought she used a different term for the short term, the up to 24 months matter, and she said she hadn't gotten any of the one that pays out for a lifetime at 75%, which is clearly the other one that from the record that's not in control. What in the record are you saying would have supported what the jury did?
Well, first of all, the evidence itself, it didn't distinguish between disability. Secondly, there was a colloquy between the court and the two lawyers in which the plaintiff's lawyer said, I think this is exactly the same. And there was a fight about it. And this was before we ever get to the motion for directed verdict in the case. And the motion for directed verdict never says that there's no evidence about this. They said it's not pled and it should be dismissed about disability. We have procedural rules to protect preservation for a reason, because there could have been clarification. We have a cross-examination so that clarification can be brought. And we have the ability to provide instructions with definitions attached to them, which would allow to clarify this. We can't retry the case now.
Well, they did argue that portion of the instruction was not supported by any evidence and should be excluded.
Well, Your Honor, the contrary argument, which is in the motion for new trial, that even if that's true, that the jury could have found that the police department had a hand in these things because there had been no money paid, that's first, and second, the police department itself was responsible for getting some of this information to the retirement system. And so we didn't have to argue that because it was never argued by the other side at any point. And that's exactly, if you want to take it to the extreme, that's what we said, is the police department had a responsibility for this as well.
Now, is this plain error review, so we have to find manifest injustice?
Your Honor, I think that if it actually exists in a civil case, which I understand Judge Smith in the Western District thinks it does, but the answer is that's the only place you can go. Is plain error review.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Now let's go to the sort of more interesting point about Google. We've had a hard and fast rule in this state for a very long time that what goes on in the jury's deliberations is not subject to review for any reason. And to Judge Teitelman's earlier point, if one of the jurors had said, Judge, Senator McCaskill had come in and said, this is what punitive damages do and all the rest of it, and the information was exactly what was on Wikipedia, would we say that that is a way to overturn the trial? No, we would say that you can't even talk about that.
You would also, the other side would have the opportunity to strike Senator McCaskill, knowing that she had that additional information in an attempt to avoid her from bringing her vast knowledge into the jury room, where anybody on Wikipedia, you do not have that opportunity.
That's a wonderful point, but it's no different than someone who took a course in high school on business law and didn't do very well in it and made the same speech.
Well, what if the court had given an instruction, and instead of giving the Missouri approved instruction,
had instructed, had given an instruction that included the information that was in Wikipedia that some of the money you give may go to the state or go to others. Would that be presumptively erroneous? And do you have any doubt that we would reverse for a new trial if that were in an instruction?
Well, I do have some doubt, particularly if it was a case like this where the error wasn't preserved about instructional error. But assuming everything came to you in the right way and it deviated from MAI, of course you'd reverse.
I was contemplating the impact of your position. And so if in a criminal case, a jury Googled when a defendant is eligible for parole and found out it's after serving 12% of their sentence and advised everybody of that, so they gave a very long sentence, is that an analogous circumstance?
Well, I think that raises the point that I think we need to go to next, and that is, what's the nature of the information itself? And I'm not one who's going to stand here and say, in this modern day and age where everybody's got something in their pocket that would calculate the thing that needs that you could send somebody to the moon, that the old Mansfield rule ought to apply. But what I am saying is, if you decide to deviate from that, then what we need to do is make a distinction between the kinds of information that's obtained. And here we know exactly. And this is where I agree respectfully with Mr. Cox. The information here is not factual information. It's fundamentally different than something, as Judge Russell said, that would contradict a witness. It is instead merely information. And if the burden had shifted, we would have put on this exact same evidence, and the judge, I am confident, would have said that we had met the burden. Because there's no clarity here as to what happened. And in fact, Mr. Hink was a whole lot more aggressive in his affidavit than he was in his testimony. Because in his testimony, he said, I read it to myself, and I'm not sure anybody heard it, but no one reacted to it.
Well, does it matter if others heard, or is it if one juror has outside information that's sufficient? Don't our cases say?
Well,
if you're entitled to 12 qualified jurors?
If the information is an extrinsic fact, it would matter. But this is information, as Judge Wilson properly found, not this gender, the other one, that
not yet,
that, you know, was pretty consistent with what the instructions had said.
But really, is it really consistent? Because instruction 11 says that the damage instruction says that you may award plaintiff such damages as you believe will fairly and justly compensate plaintiff. But yet the definition that he found on the internet indicates that the purpose of punitive damages is not to compensate the plaintiff, as plaintiff will receive all or some part. So to me that seems inconsistent.
Well, Judge, I would respectfully suggest to you that our instruction says that the purpose of punitive damages is to deter and punish. And to be
blunt.
Is that
instruction number 11?
I think it's instructions number 13 and 15 in this particular instance. I had it in the packet, but the packet was getting a little thick. But 13 and 15 are the two punitive damage instructions, and they say that the purpose is to deter and to punish.
But probably the meat of it is who's going to get the money? You know, if I'm on a jury and I give a large actual damages award, I may not want to add on much more in punitive if I think the plaintiff's going to get it all, but if I think, well, he's only going to get part of it, I may say, well, let's just up it up a little bit.
Well, it didn't say what happened. It said they might. And I guess the point of it is the instruction was telling them, pay no attention to that. Pay attention to whether it deters and punishes. And the conduct in this case is as reprehensible as you'll ever see. And frankly, given the fact that I'm now in the case and we can get a punitive multiplier based on attorney's fees, we'll get a lot more when we go back because of what we've had to do so far. But we believe, Your Honor, that this was not prejudicial in the sense that it was outcome determinative, because there was, as Judge Wilson found, a substantial lag in time between the reading of this information by this one juror, perhaps out loud, but no one reacted to, and ultimately the number.
If if there is error in this case, and if the error was that the trial court imposed the wrong burden of proof on itself, why isn't the proper remedy just to remand to the trial court and tell them that there's a presumption of prejudice and now evaluate the testimony in that light?
Well, Judge, I think that's clearly the most judicially economic thing to do if you determine it's necessary to have this done over based on some presumption. They want to go back and have the whole trial over again, but we're going to have new jurors if we send it back, and there's going to be a whole new trial, even if it's just on punitive damages. This way, the judge can apply the right standard.
Well, under the current law, the new trial, if there is a new trial, would just be punitive damages, wouldn't it?
Unless you reverse on point one. But if you reverse only on point two and remand for a new trial, we're going to have the whole shooting match over again, when it very well may be that the judge takes a look at this evidence and suggests that the presumption is overcome. If you read the state's brief here, the police department's brief, pardon me, they think this is an irrebuttable presumption, which it probably would be if these were extrinsic facts.
I don't think anybody says it's irrebuttable, but whoever has the burden of proof would have difficulty unless it were exactly consistent in showing that it's not prejudicial.
Well, even then,
so as
Judge,
a practical matter, it would be difficult to overcome.
And this is one of the reasons I think it's probably better for the court to say, take everybody's phones before they go deliberate, than it is to come up with a rule that takes us away from Mansfield. Because once you open this can of worms, it's permanently open. And we're going to start going in for all kinds of things. Not Senator McCaskill, but the bad high school students.
Well, we've always allowed evidence of extrinsic activity to come in, but not evidence as to what happened in the deliberation room. And sometimes, and when you're trying to explore was it prejudicial, it's very hard to keep that line.
Well, and I think all of us have had the experience of watching through law schools juries deliberate when we've done these sort of moot things that they do up there. And it's a very interesting, I was going to use the word frightening, but I think interesting is probably better. And we don't really know.
Well, some cases have allowed dictionary definitions.
And this is no different in my view.
Well, I mean, the argument is that a dictionary definition is more self-contained as opposed to unchecked, unverified information sometimes on the internet. But your argument basically is that although maybe the correct legal analysis wasn't employed, the right result was reached regardless.
I think if you send it back to Judge Wilson, he ends up finding exactly what he found under these circumstances, having had the opportunity, which we haven't, to review and hear what Juror Hink said. And we would, in normal circumstances, give great deference to Judge Wilson's review of the facts and his ability to judge demeanor and those sorts of things. And as always, I'm grateful to see that I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank the court for its time.
Please, the court. My good friend Judge Robertson just said that if we send it back, they're going to get more money, so I think we're all in agreement what the right thing to do is send it back.
Just on punitive damages?
No. On the whole thing.
Just want your clarification.
Right, on the whole thing. He's in the case now, so we'll see. On point one, I want to address first how this is some sort of novel thing. I mean, saying that the submission is not supported by substantial evidence is nothing new. Happened in Powderly, happened in Whitehead. And the MAI says it. It says each submission must be supported by substantial evidence. And if you make that objection at the jury instruction conference, you have preserved your right to argue that on appeal. And that's what we did. And then we brought it up in the legal memorandum in support of the new trial, which was timely filed. So this issue has been preserved. And Judge Robertson did say, well, it didn't confuse the jury. It confused the jury. Of course it did. He also mentioned that it confused trial counsel. It did. Plaintiff's counsel at trial seemed to misunderstand what the nature of these disability benefits were, as did the plaintiff and as did the jury. Reversal is proper on that, on point one. We should get an entire new trial.
But the line between submissible case and not submissible case is a very thin line. And you don't have to have a huge amount of evidence. What is that word, huge again? But you don't have to have a huge amount of evidence to make the case submissible.
Substantial and competent is the standard.
Right.
And we don't have substantial and competent evidence here. Ms. Ross Page's testimony that she did not receive a cent of disability benefits, which in context was referring to her application made to the police retirement system, is not competent to establish that we didn't give it to her. We could not have given it to her legally. So that point should mandates complete reversal. We should all go back and see what happens. On point two, opposing counsel said that what happens in the jurors' box, in the jurors' room, excuse me, is not subject to review for any reason. That's just not true. If extrinsic evidence is obtained or extrinsic information is obtained, then we do review it. And he conceded the trial court would be reversed if the judge gave the same instruction. Are we to give Juror Hink more power than we would give the trial court? Of course not. Lastly, you mentioned that I'm arguing that we have an irrebuttable presumption. That's not the case. There's a five-factor standard. It goes to the importance of the term, the extent to which the sought-after information differed, the extent to which the jurors considered it, and the strength of the evidence, and a catch-all factor. And the catch-all factor here is Wikipedia. Look at U.S. v. Lawson. It applies those five factors and says at the end, the catch-all factor, that this information was obtained from Wikipedia, trumps all. I see that my time is expiring. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.